Good morning, everybody. We're going to start, even though we are not completely set up here. One of our presenters, Trevor Munoz, wasn't able to join us today, and so he has sent a video file, which we are having trouble playing. So if we cannot play it, ultimately we'll put it on Google and send you all the link, and you can watch it at your leisure. From the beginning. Okay. Good morning. I'm Cecily Marcus. I'm from the University of Minnesota. First, I want to thank the Iowa State University for sponsoring this panel. We are grateful for the support and grateful for all of you to come here today. I am joined by my colleagues, Sarah Carlson and Kara Olledge, who I'll introduce in a minute. As well as Trevor Munoz. This is a panel that we hope will become a discussion. I think everybody says that, but we actually really mean it. So we definitely have some framing questions and guiding questions that we've been thinking about that we'll try to address and that we will talk about together, but we hope that you will bring your questions to this discussion as well. This presentation is really about what happens when you bring collections together. What do you find? What do you not find? How do systematic digitization efforts contribute to finding the canon or finding new things that you didn't know about, leading to new discoveries? So we're going to be talking about a number of different efforts from the Amistad Research Center here in New Orleans, as well as Umbresearch African American History, the University of Maryland's African American History, Culture, and Digital Humanities Initiative, ADHUME, as well as what happens when we interact between freely available archival content that we find online and licensed databases and things like that. So my fellow presenters, Trevor Munoz, who may or may not join us via video, is the interim director of the Maryland Institute of Technology and the Humanities, otherwise known as MITH, and assistant dean for digital humanities research at the University of Maryland Libraries. He is working to foster digital projects that involve collaboration between libraries, librarians, archivists, and digital humanities researchers. As a part of this work, he's written, spoken, and consulted about the strategic opportunities and challenges of doing digital humanities work within the institutional and cultural structures of the academic research library. Trevor Munoz holds an MA in digital humanities from the Department of Digital Humanities at King's College London, and an MS in Library and Information Science from the Graduate School of Library and Information Science at the University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana. He currently serves as a core team member for ADHUME, African American History, Culture, and Digital Humanities at the University of Maryland. Kara Olledge is the executive director at the Amistad Research Center, housed at Tulane University. She is a scholar, arts and educational administrator, and the Amistad is the country's oldest and largest, most comprehensive independent archive specializing in the history of African Americans and other ethnic minorities. Before coming to the Amistad Research Center, Dr. Olledge was the deputy director of the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture, a branch of the New York Public Library based in Harlem. Dr. Olledge specializes in art and educational administration and leadership and has led educational institutions and community-based organizations. She graduated from Spelman with a bachelor's degree in philosophy and a minor in art history, earned a master's in arts and arts administration from the University of New Orleans, and a PhD in educational leadership and policy at the State University of New York at Buffalo. Sarah Carlson is a graduate of the University of Minnesota and is currently a graduate student in the Department of American Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. She's an intern for the Cultural Arts Division for the City of Austin and will begin a graduate internship at the Harry Ransom Center this fall. She's an advisor to Umbresearch African American History and is the former project manager. And I'm Cecily Marcus. I'm a curator at the University of Minnesota Libraries. I work with the Givens Collection of African American Literature, the Performing Arts Archives, and the Upper Midwest Literary Archives. and I've also served as the principal investigator of Umbra Search African American Literature. I have a BA in Women's Studies and Spanish Literature from Cornell, and a PhD in Cultural Studies from the University of Minnesota. So some of the questions that we really want to talk about is what happens when convergences is really about collaboration. Who are we collaborating with? What are we trying to accomplish when we're bringing ourselves together, our materials together, our resources, and what do those convergences reveal? We also want to think about who are we doing this for? Who are our audiences? Are these convergences being driven by the collections themselves or by the people who we want to interact with these collections, the people who we want to make these collections available for, the kinds of work that may be it K through 12 students and educators, artists, scholars, professors and students at universities or what have you. What resources do we need to make this work, and what do we mean by resources? Resources isn't always just money. It's people, it's skills, it's talent, it's abilities, it's ideas, it's infrastructure, it's institutional support. So what kinds of resources are making these kinds of collaborations and convergences possible? And how do our collections help us to actively confront and then address institutional legacies of white supremacy and exclusion? If our collections are revealing and are based on, created by, some of the same powers of exclusion that we're trying to address, can we use those same collections? Do we need to change them? And so on. As one of our speakers this morning was saying, there is much in our archives that we cannot find. So part of this work, part of this discussion today is about how do we identify what is not there. And so to get us started, I don't know if this is going to work, but let's see. I think I'm not even going to try, because it'll just get too frazzled and frustrated. So if we can't get Trevor to come up on the screen by the end of the presentation, we will share his slides. But instead, let me turn directly to Dr. Olledge from the Amistad Research Center. Unless you want to go
Good morning. Good morning. I want to talk about the Amistad Research Center and a project that we started roughly a year and a half ago, which was to create an interactive and digital educational program that we could launch actually working with several partners, but really two primary partners. One was researchers, teachers, and community members who would come into the Amistad with really a lot of questions and a lot of needs around looking for resources to tell particular stories. And some of the stories that they found, they were either under-resourced or felt very uncomfortable sharing and teaching. And those were, one, slavery. That was the number one. The second one was Reconstruction. And lastly, the Civil Rights Movement. And you know, as we know, we've seen a lot of the issues nationally where we've had educators who've tried to create curriculum and projects, and unfortunately they didn't go so well. And so one of the things that we found is that teachers particularly were very hesitant to really teach those subject matters, because they wanted to make sure, one, that they were teaching them the right way, because they're very sensitive matters, and then secondly, where do they find the resources? So at Amistad Research Center, where we are, an archive that focuses on social justice, civil rights, and liberation movements for ethnic minorities, particularly in the areas of the African diaspora and African American history, we are often found as a source. And before we start and go into the presentation, I just want to say one thing. If you look at our logo, to just address one of the questions that Cecily just mentioned, about the idea of white supremacy or these unfortunate histories, particularly when it comes to our nation, is that when people often see our logo, the first thing they do is they look at the ship, and they often ask us, and they say, oh, I know, I'm familiar with Amistad. You all are a slavery archive. And we say, no, we're not a slavery archive. Actually, our history is rooted in freedom. And so that is a foundation that we use, because if you're familiar with the Amistad incident of 1839, where Africans were illegally captured and were on their way into a slave system, and were able to fight for their freedom and win their freedom, and this is a case that went all the way up to the Supreme Court. And so we look at that logo, we say, no, this is about freedom. And so one of the things that we're doing when we're shaping this educational program was, how do we really tell that narrative from that perspective? And so that's where we started with the project. The second thing I want to say is that a lot of the work that we did collaboratively actually came from working with Umbra. At the point that we were working with Cecily and Umbra, we were thinking about doing the education curriculum project around Dred Scott. And so when we were thinking about that, it gave us an opportunity to actually mine our collections and to rediscover all the wonderful collections that we had to support and develop a curriculum like this. So I think when we're looking at how we're building as a community-based organization, how do we build programs or projects that are collaborative and really rooted in a digital process? One, it's outward facing. It's working with the community and letting the community inform us about their needs. And then secondly, it's inward facing, meaning that we look at our collections and our internal relationships with other institutions that we work very closely with to look at ourselves and say, where are we, and where are we in the story, and how can we tell it? So I am going to, is this it? So just one of the guiding kind of ideas here is that the more you know your history, the more liberated you are, by Maya Angelou. And so that's one of the guiding principles and ideas that we work with at Amistad. So just a bit about the Amistad. We have more than 800 collections, 15 million original manuscripts, 2,000 plus periodicals, hundreds of thousands of photographs, oral histories, African American art, and monographs, books. As you can see the numbers right there. So we have a wealth of information that we can use and that we actually did mine to create this digital platform. Now, we talked about, when we said who's our audience, and you know, when thinking about how we're creating the program and what stories we want to tell. So these are our 2017 numbers. We're still in 2018, so we haven't pulled all those numbers together yet. But in 2017 alone, we had 800 researchers on site. A little over 1,500 students and teachers visit the centers. Chris Hart is here. He's our director of library and reference services, and he does an amazing job with his staff of doing tours with teachers and students. A little bit over 2,000 researchers via internet. We have public programs. We had a little over 1,200 in public programs, a little bit over 3,000 in combined Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram followers. So when we were designing this program, we were designing that program with that audience in mind. Who are the people that reach us in multiple ways, and what can we create and develop that would really engage those audiences with this particular program and with our collections? So I talk about Amistad on the Go. It's an interactive and digital program that pulls from the vast collections of the Amistad Research Center. One of the things that we did when we looked at this in building this program is that we knew that we had to complement the Common Core standards, looking at those areas and ways that we could really fit in and help kind of support what teachers want to get accomplished. And when we talk about teachers and community members, we mean people across the spectrum. So we were thinking in mind the most under-resourced community members, educators, homeschoolers, organizations, community organizations, to the ones that are the most resourced. So for an example, when you're thinking about this, you have to think in mind, the most resource might be a class of 20 students and they're all using iPads or computers, and their teachers are using a, you know, a digital platform to do most of their, most of the teaching, and the students are using it for most of their studies. The most under-resourced may be an institution that could only have maybe one computer in the classroom, and you know, and access to maybe digital collections might be difficult. Wi-Fi technology might be difficult. So when you're thinking about this, you think across the spectrum, and that's one of the things we considered. And so we looked at the Common Core standards of what we knew young people needed to know in terms of history, the arts, but also those soft skills too, working in teams, being able to present, those other more nuanced areas of the Common Core standards that young people have to learn. The other thing is that we wanted to make sure that it was rich and engaging curriculum. So, you know, thinking, and we would always ask, you know, many, well, Chris, put you on the spot a bit, Chris, because Chris has, Chris's son was almost kind of the litmus test, like, what are they looking at, what are they doing, you know, how much time do they spend on the phone, what kind of resources that they want to look and think about. So we want to make sure it was engaging, but that we were also hitting the key points of, are students learning primary resources? How are they using them in the classrooms? Do teachers know how to use primary resources? Do teachers know where to get them? So it was a combination of engagement, but also hitting those key points that we wanted to make sure that we were making students, I guess if you want to say, in this educational pipeline, ready by the time they get to high school, by the time they get to college. They, you know, the ongoing joke is that, you know, they get to college and Google is a resource, and we say, no, you know, Google is not a primary resource. So we wanted to make sure that they were very engaged in using resources. And then this is intergenerational. One of the things that we often hear when people come into the Amistad Research Center is that, I didn't know this. And that's across the ages. You know, we have people who are elderly who would come in and say, I didn't have this information, I didn't learn this, I would love to learn more about it, you know, all the way down to our young kids, to our young students who come in and they say, wow, I didn't know this, or I didn't know about this part of history. And so that's what we want to really help everyone learn. So now, we were gonna take a stroll on the web, but since we're having some tech issues, we're gonna stay with the slide right here. So what we did with the digital toolkit, it contains first-person narratives from primary resources, a curriculum guide, interactive worksheets, visuals for educators on the above listed right there, slavery, abolition, reconstruction, and civil rights movement. Now, in terms of collaborative approach with the community, one of the things is that we spent perhaps 7 to 8 months really working on the curriculum. Dr. Anastasia Scott, who isn't here today, is our education specialist. She and Chris worked together, and then we would meet often. But one of the things that we had in mind when we did this is that we really wanted the community to be a collaborative partner. So we decided, said, let's draft this, let's work on this. But our second step in doing so is that we wanted to get focus groups with educators and community organizations, cultural institutions, representatives from those organizations, and get them together for a series of focus groups just to make sure that the content that we were creating was hitting all the points that it needed to hit and that it was engaging. So we sat with them at the New Orleans Public Library over the course of 3 days and met with them, and they actually helped us, and they became a partner in creating this in terms of the feedback that they gave, understanding and asking really critical questions about certain terminology that was somewhat uncomfortable, you know, why was the terminology necessary, and having us, the ability for us to actually walk them through that process and understand that and get that feedback before we finish the final project. So that was really, really incredibly important to us to have them as a part of the creating, you know, the creation period, as opposed to saying, okay, we've created this, take it, and that's it. So that was one of the things that we did. And it's quite interactive. So the one thing that we did, the second thing that we did was actually thinking about doing this as a toolkit, because we were thinking about those under-resourced schools and saying, you know, should we print these documents? Should we make them available in a ready-to-mail toolkit? And when we begin to think about it, we say, I think we could still make this into a digital platform, but what we need to do is consider certain things, and some of the things we're still working through. For example, the curriculum guides that you see are all done in Yampu, which is a flip book, but we still want to make sure that they're available in PDF form, so teachers who may not have the resources to utilize a flip book in the classroom could actually have a downloadable version that they could print. There's some of the guides, like the map, which is a really wonderful, large, interactive map where students will get the stories of several Africans who had come to this continent through slavery, come to this nation through slavery, to go up there and actually identify where they came from, starting with that history of freedom going forward. And then we have all the digital components in terms of the lesson plans that teachers would need to use. Now, the way that they get there is that we look at our website, and I think most people look at their websites as educational tools and an outreach tool, and that is our first line of where we engage folks, is that looking at the website not as just an information piece of where do I go to Amistad for finding aids, or where do I go to look for the next public program, but how are we actually using our website to engage people in educational content and get the kind of feedback and get the interactions that we want. So when they come to our website and you go into, they register for the page, but all of the content can be found there. And we would have done a demo today, but we're gonna stay right in this space right now with you. So, but that is kind of like the part of the project. So the answer, I think, to a question that Cecily brought up about this idea about white supremacy, and how can you address them? I think one of the things is that really mining your collections and doing a very, very deep dive, you'll be amazed in what you will find. Secondly, it's how you choose to tell your story. When Amistad decides to tell a story, it's not really in response to white supremacy at all. When we tell our story, we're telling our story from a position of resilience, a position of strength, and a position of freedom. Because that is what, when you look at Amistad's mission, we're exactly about. And we work with our partners in doing so. So one of the things that we do a very wonderful job of public programs. But we've worked with 11 organizations, a combination of academic institutions here, Dillard University, Tulane University, Xavier University, as well as the New Orleans Jazz Museum, which is a part of Louisiana State Museums, and several cultural community-based organizations to create the New Orleans Arts and Culture Coalition. And a big part of that coalition is utilizing this information in relationship to an exhibition that we have. And that exhibition, if you haven't had an opportunity to see it, I would encourage you to do so, is at the Historical New Orleans Collection. But it looks at 300 years of the African presence in New Orleans. And that story is totally shaped and rooted in those ideas of resilience, strength, and freedom. And so I think at this point, since we're not going to do the tour, I could say thank you. I hope that I've answered your questions. And I'm happy to answer any other questions that you have going forward.
I'm Sarah Carlson. I, as Cecily mentioned, am now at UT Austin, but was formerly in Minnesota working on the Ember Search Project, which I'll reference at times, and then Cecily will be able to talk a little bit more about it. When I first said I would speak on this panel with her, I said, yeah, I'll talk about Ember Search, and then I had been working on another project as a graduate research assistant and thought, this I need to bring to RBMS because I have so many questions. So this is more of me posing an instance where I was working with kind of a converging collection and just thought this is not what I expected, and hopefully in our discussion we can talk a little bit more about this. So kind of an intro is I was working with various materials at the Harry Ransom Center, a photograph collection by John Spivak, who was a photojournalist, went to document the conditions of prison camps and chain gangs in Georgia in the 1930s, specifically 1931. He also had kind of purloined letters and punishment reports and diet reports from these camps that were full of names, and including both those who were convicted as well as and incarcerated, as well as those who were in charge of these camps. And my assignment was to look through and try to understand kind of the demographics, the makeup, and the trends of camp assignments and punishment, and kind of cross-reference to be able to tell the stories of individuals who only had a photograph and maybe a first name on the back scrawled by the photographer. So looking at other collections and try to build a convergence for a digital exhibition later on. So immediately I went to Georgia Archives. And they have incredible materials. They have just huge bounds of prison reports, as well as registers of convicts from Civil War all the way through the 1960s. But Georgia Archives has kind of a contested history. The Georgia Department of Archives and History was founded in the early, I believe, 1900s. By the 1930s, it was under the Secretary of State, and the governor decided that that was no longer an appropriate spot. The city and state legislators were looking to zero out the budget and get rid of this division of kind of the Georgia State Library system. They created a contingency plan around the 1930s of what to do if the Secretary of State no longer housed these records, because suddenly around the 1930s, so many materials were coming in, they didn't know what to do with it. The plan was, if this should ever happen, they would go to the University System of Georgia. Luckily, things worked out. They maintained a lot of their records, stayed within the state. But in 2012, I believe, they did move to the University System of Georgia. And so now the Georgia Archives, Georgia State Archives, are at in Morrow, Georgia, at Georgia University of Georgia. So this is a type of kind of convergence that is somewhat unprecedented, where you have state archives and state collections being housed and managed by a university system that usually has pretty different records. They have limited budgets. Around the mid 2010, 2012, there were three people on staff. They're slowly coming back from that with more and more reference librarians and archivists, but still limited in their capacity. And so these records that are in high demand, these register of convicts, are frequently used by scholars as well as genealogists, but they just couldn't keep up with it. And so they made a partnership with Ancestry.com to digitize and house the digital surrogates of these materials. I have at the bottom implosion, enter PPP to build new facility. This is kind of now looking forward, just kind of a symbol of maybe what's happening to some of these partnerships, where you implode on yourself. So they actually imploded the State Archives building not too long ago to build a new facility, but it was, in reading, a kind of a comic, although somewhat tragic, image of the ways that entering a public-private partnership can ultimately create new opportunities, but really kind of damage the existing infrastructure that started in the first place. Ancestry.com, I had changed these and now I'm realizing I didn't save them, but Ancestry.com is the largest for-profit private genealogy company in the world. They are, I'm sure you see them everywhere around Father's Day, so that you can get Dad to get his subscription and he can find out who his grandpa was and his great-grandpa, and he can also now do a DNA test to see what percent of Irish American he is and what percent of German American he is. Ancestry.com comes out of work with the Church of Latter-day Saints. It has paywalls and subscriptions. They have many arms of services and subsidiaries, including digitization efforts. Family Search is actually kind of built into Ancestry.com's giant company. And a lot of Ancestry.com comes out of this white ethnic revival that Matthew Fry Jacobson talks a lot about. Of course, genealogy has always been a wonderful kind of history and practice in African American communities and communities of color. But ancestry really taps into this white ethnic identity, where they are emphasizing, you know, how much percentage of Irish American are you. They also build upon the resources they already have, and so it kind of continues this cycle of privileging white historical records. There was a news story about their DNA component, and there's a really wonderful book called Future Face coming out about it, about how the information they have builds on the library of information they already have, right? So they can give you really excellent results if you're a mix of white ethnic identities because they already have a large database to work against to reference. If you're a person of color, they have less information to begin with, and so the results are always a little bit foggier. That's kind of the same with the records that they have as well. A lot of their users are predominantly white ethnics who are transcribing records for free. So the technology and partnership. Here are some of the kind of the resources that were pooled when Georgia Archives and Ancestry decided to do what I think is a generous term partnership. Ancestry.com digitized all of these records. There are, each ledger is usually about 500 to 1,000 images or pages. And there are at least 12 that I looked through. So they digitized and then also hosted these materials. And then they used their crowdsourcing efforts to transcribe all of these indexes. We can get into that a little bit later. The indexes are complete. The project is, for the most part, done. Georgia Archives, what they gave into this partnership was a huge audience that had really defined active users. People were using these materials already. You could access them through microfilm at the Georgia Archive, but how many people can travel to Morrow, Georgia? And rich content. These records have everything from first and last name to age to county where they were convicted, county where they lived, and then all of the camps or chain gangs that they traveled through during incarceration. Usually someone was convicted not necessarily in the county that they lived, and often they were not incarcerated in the county that they were convicted in. So there was a lot of moving about, which is really important if you're trying to trace a family history or you're trying to do research on the conditions of Georgia prison camps and chain gangs. Here is an example of if you're looking at Ancestry.com for the Central Register of Convicts. What you'll see is the name column. There's the number that they were assigned, the crime that they committed. These are all misdemeanors. So larceny, burglary was very a common one. Sometimes it would just be someone kind of loitering and standing around. And they'd be incarcerated for many, many years, going to at least 7 camps oftentimes. And then as you move down, you'll have height, weight, age. They'll have a race column, which is illuminating for whoever was booking these convicts, and then also all of the locations, etc. You'll see at the bottom the index is fairly incomplete actually compared to all the information that's in the record. You have age and name, you don't usually have gender recorded, and actually there were men and women. African-American women were disproportionately represented in the Georgia prison system, but that's not captured in the index, which is what most people use when they're searching Ancestry.com. And then the biggest problem for me was that they didn't record the prison locations, which is really the part where you see the displacement of families, of individuals, and kind of a snapshot of the life they lived while being incarcerated. I should note that a lot of these individuals, mostly African-American men, are represented in these records. I think it's safe to say that beyond these records, they might not be found in the historical record many times. So this is really where we find them. Their life is captured while they're in incarceration and not after. And now that they're in the Ancestry.com database, they're behind paywalls, right? So their life is first confined, and then their history is also confined. So that's the absence, is what we lose. These are public institutions and state records that are now being held by private corporations. Accessibility is a real problem. I think we all know the joys of really rich digital collections. We'll see in Umbra kind of what you can do when you can search across collections, which I suppose you could do in Ancestry.com. I can find materials from Mississippi or from Alabama, but it's not easy to search across those collections, right? They're very siloed by Georgia state records, Mississippi state records. And then just the interface. Search is really difficult. You have to know exactly what you're looking for. In the index, so the metadata enrichment and standards, this metadata is pretty simplistic for good reason. I mean, if you're doing a simple genealogical search for maybe a couple of generations, you don't need that much. But if you're doing anything larger, it's going to be difficult to find somebody. Oftentimes, there are aliases within these registers. Those aren't captured in the index that's transcribed. So if you only know of someone who goes by their alias in your family records or in this photograph at the Harry Ransom Center, you're not going to find them in here, even though that name is certainly there. It's totally erased in the crowdsourcing transcription process. And so then this is what I started doing. I thought, I need to know these locations, I need to know the transfers, and so I created a Google spreadsheet, and that's where I was working for many months to supplement the work that many others did. The indexes were wonderful, they were incredibly helpful, and I'm glad that they were available. But unlike working with a public institution, a university, where normally if they had indexes, they would likely share them with me, right, to make them accessible. I could either view them as an Excel file or some kind of spreadsheet if it was online. You can't download the index from ancestry.com, so you need access to internet always to look at these. You need to pay the $20 subscription fee per month to access these records. And then you need the time to go through and supplement the metadata that may not have been recorded. And hopefully the metadata you do have was recorded correctly. I'm not sure what their quality control is like, but imagine, you know, thousands of users from across the world. Some might not even speak English, but will transcribe English materials if they have some kind of, you know, working knowledge of reading it. And so this is what I moved on to. Although, how do I share this now, right? Because Georgia Archives does not have this index. I asked if they could share it with me, since I presume they have a contract with Ancestry and they share things. But the photographs on Ancestry.com can be downloaded one at a time for reference. They're mega files. They take a long time. And all of them are copyrighted by Ancestry.com. They are owned by Ancestry. And Georgia Archives is not getting a great deal out of this. It's referenced, I guess, at the very bottom of each page that these are from Georgia Archives, but the context of a finding aid, the context of the collections that it lives with at the Georgia Archives is totally lost. And if I were not someone who had found them from an archive in the first place and was told by their reference librarian, you need to pay for an Ancestry account, I would not really understand that these are archival materials. I would not really understand the role that the Georgia Archives played in the first place for these. And I would also not really understand the context within which these materials were created. A history of, as Cecily has been talking about, white supremacy, of labor, of racial capitalism, of commodification of bodies. So Ancestry.com gave me access to wonderful materials. I'm continuing to use them. But this is a type of collaboration that felt one-sided. And I think we need to think about that when we talk about converging collections. When are they beneficial to both or multiple parties? And when are we kind of privileging one type of institution because it seems like it's maybe the only good deal? Not the best deal, but it's the only deal we can make. And when we do have converging collections, we also have converging audiences. How do we make sure that genealogists and scholars can work in the same space? Because I think there is a great loss when they're working in two separate arenas and they're siloed. These are jobs, these are pieces of history that really are beneficial to each other if we'll let them. So I think as Cecily moves into talking about umresearch.org, we can maybe think about what do we do when we have a lot of different users trying to access these rich collections. Thank you.
Thank you, Kara and Sarah. So I'm going to talk about umresearch.org, and I'll explain in a minute what that is. Through the lens of the idea of the incomplete archive. This this question, how are our collections always necessarily incomplete, has been at the heart of the work that I have pursued since I was a graduate student. It's an interest in how history can come to account for that which hasn't been documented, or of the times and peoples and ideas and impulses that perhaps were documented but remain private, secreted away, destroyed. There are more times in history than we can count, including in our own times, when people destroy their own materials, their own documents, their own work, so not to be betrayed by their own ideas. And then, of course, there are times when others destroy their work. So if an archive or in a library can be thought of as a repository for the possibility of understanding the past and our own present, for putting together pieces of a time or experience in a way that sheds light or truth onto even those things that we thought we already understood, then there's always more than that we can know. There's more that we can discover. There will always be key pieces that are still missing that need to be identified. So the incompleteness of the archive, the absence of documents, and the ways that these losses are represented and remembered has driven my work before I came into archives and special collections, and they have been the driving and organizing force between much of the work I've done as a curator and as the principal investigator for Umbra Search. So Umbra Search is an online search tool and program. It brings together currently about 820,000 primary source and historical materials from over 1,000 different libraries and archives in the United States. We have founding partners such as the Digital Public Library of America, from which a great deal of our content is coming, the Library of Congress, the Chomburg Center for Research in Black Culture, the Amistad Research Center, Howard University, and many more. Umbra Search has grown to include many more institutional partners and content providers. It also includes a mass digitization effort of African American materials at the University of Minnesota that aren't just in African American collections, and community engagement and outreach and education efforts to build audiences and to share Umbra Search. We've hosted many different types of collaborative events, both in the Twin Cities as well as at Howard, UCLA, Emory, Penn, and other places. But despite an aggregation of what should be over a million records before the end of the year, Umbra Search is really hamstrung in certain ways. It can only bring together, first, what we've collected, second, what we've described in a way that can be identified as having something to do with African American history, broadly understood, and then what has been digitized. And so those are three, you know, pretty significant barriers that cut down on the amount of materials that, despite what might actually even we might have collected, are not going to be found in Umbra Search. We all, I think, understand that, you know, even if you look at the history of African American collections in the United States, the Amistad Research Center, Howard, Moreland Spring Arn at Howard, the Schomburg Center, these are collections that are less than 100 years old, correct? 50. Amistad is celebrating its 52nd. These are materials that that were not a priority for many institutions to collect for hundreds of years and for the existence of many of these institutions. Many of them have not been described in any way that reveals what they're actually about. And then we digitize, you know, many of us don't have the opportunity to digitize systematically or deeply within or across our collections. We digitize on demand, we digitize what a researcher needs for a book cover, what we need for our exhibits, and rarely do we have the opportunity to really pull everything together from a collection or go across collections. So we wanted to think about how we're going to represent what isn't there. It's difficult to see what you can't see. And it's even more difficult to do that in an interface that is supposed to be about discovery and access and understanding. So even the name Umbra is a way to reference some of these ideas. Umbra is the Latin term for the darkest part of the moon's shadow. what's the central and the core part of the moon's shadow. And this is one way that we attempt to gesture towards not only what still remains in the shadows, what hasn't been collected, what isn't common knowledge, what hasn't been taught in schools, but also the centrality of African American history to understanding American history. That it's not marginal, it's not something on the side, but it's actually core to understanding who we are. We have many, many partners for UM Research, and I think one of the things that we can talk about today is, you know, what do we mean by partners? Because there are always different kinds of partnerships. Some of our partners are institutions with whom we have worked very closely, with whom we have had conversations about where are the collections that you have that haven't been digitized that would add value not only to your own digital collections, but also to something like UM Research, which is an extra layer of discovery and platform of discovery for those materials. How can we help you think about those collections, and how perhaps might UM Research help justify putting those collections up in the queue for processing, for enhanced metadata, for digitization? Some of the partnerships are with institutions that aren't libraries and archives, that don't have digital collections, but may have affinity missions. They're about promoting African American history, bringing African American writers and celebrating their work. It could be all kinds of things. And so we might have partners who we partner with for events or for focus groups or different forms of outreach, but aren't necessarily providing content. And then we have a number of partners who are providing making their digital collections available through DPLA, through the Digital Public Library of America. And yet we've also talked with them about how research works, how their collection is playing a part in it, we want to know what they're going to be digitizing next, what they're collecting, and we also can talk with them about integrating a part of UM Research onto their website, because UM Research isn't just a website, it's also a widget. It's a little piece of code that can live on a course page or in any kind of online environment so that you don't have to know to go to umresearch.org in order to find UM Research. So this is what UM Research looks like right now. The focus of it is definitely the search box. You can put in any terms and suggestions will also come up that are based on the metadata that we have. UM Research is an aggregation. It's not a digital collection. We are only working with the metadata and thumbnail images that are harvested through an application programming interface, basically, a straw that will connect servers together so that we can bring all of the metadata in, filter it through a very large and in some ways problematic search strategy that we can talk about if you're interested, in order to identify all of the materials in a digital collection that might be relevant to UM Research. So there's been a lot of work that has gone into taking out materials that are about bird migration, for example, rather than the Great Migration. But this is a picture of the search results page. These are materials coming from the Amistad Research Center. And so if you're searching a particular subject, you're going to find materials not just from one institution, but from all institutions that might have contributed material that shares that metadata, basically. You can go to a full record result, which will include whatever metadata has been provided by the host institution, Amistad Research Center in this case, as well as other materials that might be related in terms of format, subject, collection, as well as other keywords that might help expand or sometimes reduce that search. But really the point of UM Research is to take you off of UM Research, much like the Digital Public Library of America, and to take you directly to that host home in digital collection so that the integrity of how that object, the introducing Charles Evers, fits within a larger collection or a larger institution. Because that is one of the things that can get lost in some of the searching of UmbraSearch. As well as UmbraSearch.org and the website and the widget, we also identified and recognized in the course of this work that the materials that we at the University of Minnesota were contributing to our own digital collections that had to do with African American history were slight on the one hand, but also that, you know, if this idea is true, which I believe it is, that you cannot understand American history without understanding African American history, then you are going to find materials about African American history in every collection, in the social welfare history archives, in the Treader collection of GLBT studies, in children's literature, in the history of the YMCA, et cetera. And so across about 17 different collecting areas at the University of Minnesota, we identified close to about 500,000 materials from 162 collections, which has grown to now to be over 200 collections of different materials. We applied for a CLEAR digitization grant. I should mention that much of the development of UmbraSearch and even the planning stages were funded by the Institute of Museum and Library Services. And one of the stipulations of a CLEAR grant, digitization grant, is that you have to digitize materials at a box or folder level. You cannot go and pick out, sort of in a curatorial way, all of the different materials from different folders that you want to digitize. And so we worked with our colleague curators and archivists to identify where beyond what we could find in our finding aids we would find these materials. We've also spent a lot of time enhancing the metadata. When we find a folder from the YMCA archives that says indoor activities, and it's actually pictures of African American kids in the 1930s in New York City doing different kinds of art projects, we're going to change the description of the folder. It's not going to be called indoor activities anymore. It might still be called indoor activities, but there will be additional metadata. And then we're working to retranslate that metadata from our digital collection record back into the finding aid. To date, this is actually a little bit out of date. We're almost done with our digitization, and the rest of the project is going to be about copyright clearance as well as metadata enhancement and working with archive space and things like that. Sort of on a quarterly basis, these materials are being added to our own digital collections, then aggregated by the DPLA, then re-aggregated by UmbraSearch. We've also tried to really describe and bring stories and bring out the stories that these materials are revealing, working with our partners to create digital exhibits on hashtag UmbraSearch, UmbraSearch blog, which gives you more context for many of these collections. So we have had our partners at Temple University write about their materials from the Bloxon collection, for example, or for Payne Theological Seminary in Ohio, telling more of the story of these collections. We've also worked with students who are creating digital projects and hosting them on the UmbraSearch blog. Community engagement has been an important part of this project from the beginning. The ideas of what has now become UmbraSearch came out of working with artists from all over the country talking about the challenges of creating and maintaining archives, working specifically with artists of color and talking about where those archives are, who needs to be able to find them, who needs to be able to use them, what they need to be able to use them for. And so much of UmbraSearch's energy has also been spent thinking about how we can really activate these materials. How can we make them, bring them alive? And we're not the ones who are going to do that necessarily. That's going to be done by artists in residence. That's going to be done by high school students. That's going to be done by university students and scholars. And so we've partnered, as I said, all over the country as well as the Twin Cities, to host events that could be about archives, but that could also be about some you know, some aspect of African American art in the Twin Cities, you know, about all kinds of different things that have to do with African American history. We've partnered with a hackathon for social justice, where we're talking about how can we use open data about African and put it in a social justice context, for example. We've also some of the work that Dr. Olledge has been talking about, we've developed some teaching tools that really address not just the content of Umbra Search, but how do you differentiate, how do students come to understand the difference between a primary source and a secondary source. The materials in Umbra Search, and I would love to hear more from you, Dr. Olledge, about how students are approaching primary sources, because primary sources can be challenging, right? We may not always have the metadata that really gives them an understanding of what things are. So how do we bring primary sources into conversation with secondary sources, but also how do we let students know what they are not going to find if all they're using is Google? And so we've developed a very simple exercise that really can be applied in all kinds of digital collections contexts. It doesn't have to be Umbra Search. It could be DPLA, it could be your own institution's digital collection, of comparing the search results from a Google search to a search within your own digital collection. What kinds of materials are you finding? Who were they created by? Where did they come from? How are they being described? And it's pretty incredible how, you know, if somebody does a search for, you know, Black Panther Party, for example, you're going to find Wikipedia, history.com, you know, maybe Time Magazine in your top results of a Google search. You might find materials from a university's digital collection and page, 57 of your search results, but how many of you have gotten past the second page of a Google search result? So that content may be there, but it's not going to find, it's not going to come up. You do that same search in a digital collection, you're going to find Black Panther newspapers. You're going to find redacted FBI reports. You're going to find propaganda posters and artwork and images by different kinds of artists. So it's going to lead those searches into very different directions, and students understand immediately why they're going to find different kinds of things in different kinds of collections, and what the value of a digital collection, a library's collection, and archives can be. This work has really changed the way that the University of Minnesota has thought about the power of archives and special collections. It has had a big impact on the kinds of audiences that we are serving. It has engaged scholars in conversations about how they can partner with libraries to create their own Umbra searches. It sort of brought up the question, is Umbra Search like a brand? Can you have Umbra Search Chicano art? Can you have Umbra Search bioethics? Or is there something specific about Umbra Search that has to do with African American history, and the technology may be applied in other ways, but Umbra Search itself is its own thing. Fundamentally, it's changed how the libraries partners with other institutions around shared goals of access, and it's changed the way the libraries think about its own digital infrastructure, its digital platforms, and questions around sustainability and strategy for digital and technological growth. One of the things that has been the most impactful for me is going back to this question of how can we see what's not there? Because you bring together something that is going to have 822,000 potential results, which is actually more, because many objects are actually compound objects. A folder might be one object in that 822,000, but it actually has 50 pages or 100 pages or what have you. But how do you come back to seeing what is not there? And one of the things that you can see in Umbra Search, one of the things that by bringing all of these different digital collections together, we can see what we've duplicated, the ways in which we have all collected some of the same things, the ways in which we have all digitized some of the same things. The ways that we have canonized something that perhaps has also been argued as a sort of a non-canonical disruption of the canon. So how we've canonized African American history itself. When you do a search and number search and you don't find a result, it doesn't give, right now we're not giving you a lot of information about why that might be. Perhaps someone might think that they entered the wrong search term, or perhaps they put the quotation marks in the wrong place or something like that. We are not providing sort of a pop-up message that says, you're not finding this because we haven't collected it. You're not finding this because we haven't named it in a way that makes sense. You're not finding it because we haven't digitized it. Just yesterday, I was talking with one of the book dealers about the Afro-American Broadcasting Incorporation, something I know nothing about, and was interested, and looked in UmbraSearch to see if there was anything there, and there's not. So UmbraSearch isn't yet really, I think, doing as much as it could to really reveal, you know, what's behind the missing records. And that's something that I'm interested in getting feedback about, as well as talking about. And that brings up all kinds of questions about how we're building our collections, how we are structuring our collection development plans, what the role of archives and special collections is in the recovery, preservation, and access of collections that exist outside of our institutions, what kinds of relationships and partnerships we can establish that are custodial, that are non-custodial, that are hosting digital content, but perhaps not in the same way that Ancestry.com is. And we are also thinking a lot about sustainability. And I think that the questions of sustainability that UmbraSearch is facing are not specific to UmbraSearch. I think in any context where you build, you have a large digital project that is built on grant support, over the course of, you know, however many years, that grant support is going to end. We have fulfilled the objectives that we laid out in the beginning. We aggregated content, we brought it together, we made it available, we've done community outreach, we're digitizing content, all of that. And yet at each stage of that work, more possibilities have been revealed, right? It has only revealed how much more work there is yet to be done. And the conversations that we have had with partners and advisors have only affirmed and, you know, taken those conversations even farther afield. The role, we have an advisory council, both Dr. Olledge and Sarah Carlson are on it, as well as Athena Jackson and a number of others. It's an advisory board that is not just of library and university people. We have artists, we have educators, K-12 educators, people from the University of Minnesota, as well as all over the country. You know, that is a critical aspect of not only sharing the work that we've done, but thinking strategically about how we're going to continue it. The role of partners is one that I cannot underestimate. When we first started this project, we believed that this content is openly available online. We can just bring it together. We've all made it, you know, available, so why can't we just put it in one place? Well, actually, we needed to talk with partners about declaring their metadata CC0 if they hadn't already. We needed to establish relationships in order to establish APIs with institutions that weren't participating or won't ever participate with something like DPLA. That began with phone calls and emails, perhaps to a digital archivist or a digital collections person, and then would progress to a curator or a director of archives and special collections or a dean of libraries or a provost. Some of these were legal agreements that needed to be signed at an institutional level. And despite the headache that might have created, it also created institutional buy-in. So now we have people who are expecting us to maintain UmbraSearch, to grow UmbraSearch. And that's a very useful thing when you're talking about sustainability. But it has also brought opportunities in terms of the kinds of collaborations that we've engaged with. Some of the questions about around sustainability for UmbraSearch, it's not just, you know, will UmbraSearch stay online? Yes, it will. Will the content grow? Yes, it will. We will continue to do harvests every quarter. But will it change? Will it get better? Those are some of the questions that we're asking institutionally, but it's also led to conversations with colleagues around the country about digital platforms, national digital platforms generally. What African American collections. What happens when you center a digital platform or digital humanities around Black studies and African American history, rather than you use a digital platform that can just reveal parts of African American history? How can we work with our colleagues to understand what's in our collections and what we should be digitizing, what we haven't collected? Can we do that in any systematic way? Is there a survey we should be doing? Should we be working within, you know, with just a couple of institutions? These are conversations that we're having with history makers, with AdHume and Myth at University of Maryland, and with others. And so a lot of the sustainability of UmResearch might be about how are we really going to be representing cultural diversity in our digital collections. UmResearch might just be a vehicle for displaying that, but it may not be where the work has to happen. So with that, I say thank you. I certainly have some questions, but I think rather than starting with those, we'd love to start with your questions if you have any. Thank you.
So hearing you talk about UmResearch and being able to take away, like moving away from UmResearch to the home institutions' websites and collections and things like that is really awesome to see, because I think we've got a lot of conflicting ideas of, do we just dump all of these images into a collection and hope researchers find their way back? And we're like, no, because they won't. And we'll have to be that intermediary step, which we love to be, but if we can't, we need to make sure that they can get back there. So, can you talk a little bit about challenges in terms of overcoming obstacles like that by making all of these things accessible, but then coming up against barriers that you don't think about in terms of how are they going to find their way back? And if they're finding it through Google, which so many of our students come to us through, how are they getting the metadata and the information and the connections back from those digital images into the collections and representing it sort of that way?
Wow, I don't know if I can even answer that. I think that's a great philosophical problem, right? I mean, I think, you know, in some ways it has to do with how we have visualized and created sort of that digital collection interface, and the kinds of information that we've made very apparent and the kinds of information that we haven't. I think I'll talk about it with a question that I have in terms of how UmResearch is doing it. For our own materials from the University of Minnesota that we've been digitizing over the past couple of years, we have put a link to the collection. Let me make sure I don't say this backwards. If you find an image in UmResearch from the University of Minnesota, it will take you to the University of Minnesota Digital Collections Interface, which is called UMedia, which is going to change, of course. And within the metadata of that record, it will have a link to the collection, to the rest of the collection from which this material came, because it may be a compound object, but it's only one folder from a much larger collection, for example. That link, though, should that link take you to that folder in the finding aid, in the EAD in archive space, that folder, or should it take you to the larger collection level landing page of the finding aid so that you can understand more of the context, and then expect users to navigate their way through archive space, which we all know user interface is getting better. you know, are we going going to expect the user then to navigate back down into wherever that folder within this very large collection might reside. And I think there's an argument on both sides, right? That you should be able to go exactly to this folder in a collection, but that might be the only folder that's been digitized of the whole collection, or should you go to the collection landing space? And I actually don't know what the answer is. I think it makes sense in both ways. And then on the flip side, if you are looking at the finding aid and you don't know that something's been digitized, you're going to find a link to, you know, to that material in your digital collection, not to UmbraSearch. You won't get to UmbraSearch from your own digital collection necessarily. So, you know, all that, there are tons of ways of navigating that I think we haven't quite really come to understand. But and more information isn't always best, right? Because then we can just create more links and people will have no idea where they've landed and why they've gotten there. So I unfortunately don't think I have a good answer. If someone else does, and if you can answer the question of where should we be linking to, the full record of the finding aid or that part of the finding aid within the finding aid, you know, let me know. Sorry.
No, that's great, because it talks a lot about balance and where you're going to put this and how people are going to find it and not duplicating. You know, linking out in multiple places, which just makes it more confusing, but you also want to teach your users how to find things in the finding aid. So I think that's actually great.
And how we can make the individual record for that thing that they found in the first place as rich as possible.
Exactly.
Right? Because not everyone is going to even travel through to the finding aid.
Yeah.
So.
Hi, my name is Elizabeth Cruces from the University of Houston, and my question is for Sarah regarding the Georgia Archives. You know, as comfortable as you are and as much as you know, could you elaborate on the decision-making, like, of going with Ancestry.com? Was it something that came from, you know, administration, who is very disconnected sometimes from the work that we do and why we do the work the way that we do it? Because, as you mentioned, it looks like a raw deal for the archive, but, you know, what components came into that decision-making? What did Georgia Archives maybe think that they were getting into? Thank you.
Yeah, that is Elizabeth. That is a really great question. I was treading very lightly with the Georgia Archives. I was pretty vague in my initial requests for materials. I didn't want them to know immediately what I was researching, that I was trying to find out, you know, how discriminatory or how brutal these prison camps or chain gangs would be. Right? I didn't want my agenda to be that apparent, and so I was initially pretty vague until I had to be very explicit, because the resources are tight. There are not a lot of people, you know, filling requests, and just capacity was limited. So when I had to be a little bit more explicit for what I needed, and was told by a really wonderful and highly responsive reference librarian, reference archivist, that my best bet would be Ancestry.com if I could not afford to come to Morrow, Georgia, which I certainly couldn't. This was all research that I was doing so that the faculty member who has some research money could then go and make the most of his trip, right? And so I was given options of either I could come into the reading room and look at microfilm, which they admitted was not great, or I could not look at the physical copies, or I could go to Ancestry.com. And upon pressing, I said, I don't have an Ancestry account, I really don't have the budget for an Ancestry account. The option was to either find a public library. Many public libraries have Ancestry subscriptions. But the kind of research I was doing, and I imagine many people do, takes hours, if not weeks or months, or possibly years if I had continued digging down this hole, and I just couldn't imagine being at the public library that much, and also kind of hogging the computers that they might have, which might be limited. And so I convinced my department chair to pay for an Ancestry account for the academic year, and it was expensive. It's with tax, like $22 a month. And that eats away at the budget really quickly. So I quickly wrote to Georgia Archives and asked, you must have these large files from Ancestry, or do you have the index that was created
from, it's called the World Archive Project. And they do not have the index, is that at least what I was told, and I didn't want to press because I want to have a good relationship with them should I need them again. And they couldn't make, it wasn't clear if they had the images, but they couldn't make them accessible to me, basically. It sounded like the reference archivist I was talking with knew this was not a great deal. I imagine that, and they're pretty tight-lipped about it, though, right? I also wrote to Ancestry.com, which is, I went to their customer service, it's not a reference archivist, it's a customer service FAQ page, and tried to find out a little bit about, like, when did this partnership happen, and could I get the index from them, which certainly not. I was not allowed to download the index from them. The index that I did have in a Google spreadsheet was for me copy and pasting page after page, so it's recto verso for thousands and thousands and thousands of pages. And so I have a feeling that this happened when Georgia Archives left the Secretary of State and went to the university, and there was a staff of two or three, and they closed office hours in 2012. They were not accepting researchers. They only had the budget to have two people, like an ED and an archivist, and nobody was researching. So they opened up office hours again, and you can now actually work in the reading room at the University of Georgia. So I think this was all with restructuring of them moving to the university system of Georgia. But I haven't investigated deeper. I think I will find out more when this research project is all done, and I and my faculty member have what they need before I start. I'm like, hey, you, who made this decision?
Yeah. I'd love to talk to you after the session because I can speak for my institution alone. And we've been approached by, they present themselves as very well-intentioned, and that they're trying to relieve the burden because you probably don't have a digitization department, so we're a proprietary database vendor and we'll digitize our whole collection, and sometimes, if you don't read the contract, there's implications, but so there's usually contracts that go behind. So that's what I was wondering, like, did you have access to, and it sounds like probably, unfortunately, the archivist there didn't even know what they was being committed to.
And so. That's the state of things. I also don't want to cast Georgia Archives as if they're in a negative light. This is an institution that has had, as we talked about, a lot of contentious moments of will it survive in its history, and it has always really done what it needs to keep the doors open. And so while this is not an ideal situation, I think they did what they needed to make sure that their patrons could find access should they need it remotely. So
I think it's more funding with that. We make deals with the devil.
Exactly.
I just want to say also, we could talk to you as well. We entered an agreement that was quite successful with an institution, and had our race relations collections digitized. And so we'd be happy to talk to you. I know Chris is here, some other folks here, to talk to you also about a successful partnership and what you should be mindful of going into, into any kind of agreement like that.
Hi, my name is Morgan Swan. I work at Dartmouth College in the woods in New Hampshire. We've been fortunate enough to receive a one-year sort of lump of money from the provost to launch a historical accountability initiative, looking into the history of our institution and looking at issues of diversity and inclusivity. And the idea is to have students conduct most of the research into the archives to find this information with guidance from our institutional history research specialist who's going to oversee the work. And then I will supervise that person. And the end product is supposed to be some sort of like web-based platform deliverable. I would just love to hear any advice you guys have about making sure that we're finding the right kinds of information and we're making it available in a way that is most helpful to not just sort of local professors' pet projects, but also to the larger community, nationally, globally, what have you.
Well, I think one of the things, and I know we talk about partnerships, and we always look at institutions as partnerships, but I really think every person that comes through the door is really partnering with us in terms of helping us understand our collections, but also guiding and helping us think about
what we should be thinking about in terms of our collection. So when we have community members that come in and ask questions, we get a lot of genealogy questions, which is not our wheelhouse, but we get them. Or we get questions around particular topics, or like I mentioned earlier, we start talking about that, because then it's like, okay, so we understand that there's a gap. How can we fill that gap? And start with those questions as your guiding questions, as opposed to creating questions. So it's kind of like not just saying, like, you know, 10 people ask about this, but, you know, someone asked this really, really good question, or we've been getting these tours. And one example I know is, and this is actually predates me, but and Chris could probably talk about this, where he had a tour and did a whole exhibition on Black comics. And using that information from the students who asked those questions, and saying, you know, we should be doing something about this or collecting in this area. So I think that's one thing you can do. And then the other thing is, I think in terms of creating platforms, is look at your peer institutions and see what they're doing and what they're using. That was extremely helpful to me and the staff, I think, when we started to think about what we wanted this to look and feel like, and keep it as open-ended as possible. And always be flexible and open enough to get feedback. And I always say, get your feedback along the way. Don't complete the project. And I hope that's helpful, because I know we got a lot of great feedback about some things, and some of the things we just simply had to course correct on. So I think that's, to me, the best approach to take, and I'd be happy to talk about more details, but maybe in a more general sense, those kinds of the ways that we've moved, you know, really help us.
The only thing I would add is that there was an exhibit at the University of Minnesota, a facsimile exhibit on the second and third floor of the library where Archives and Special Collections is held last summer, that had more traffic, more groups of students, more faculty, more groups of community members of all ages from all different parts of the Twin Cities coming to see this exhibit than any other. And it was about the history of anti-Semitism, racial segregation, and surveillance at the University of Minnesota in the 1930s. It was curated by a professor, but you know, her with the help of graduate students and undergraduates as well, you know, looking at university archives for the most part, you know, president's office records, and you know, all kinds of stuff. Mostly text that people actually sat there and read in the full. But having, you know, thinking about how to bring these materials out, not just on a website, but within a larger context that people can actually see in your own institution, can be really, really impactful. You know, often, you know, these kinds of endeavors will lead to, you know, presidents of universities saying, okay, well, what are we going to do now, and convening committees about thinking about how buildings are named and, you know, all of that. Knowing in advance that is going to be, that is a need, that it's not just going to be in response to this report or this, you know, whatever it is that comes up, but that is, you know, part of the effort from the beginning, I think, is also, is also something that makes a difference. And it doesn't have to be a reaction. It is the intention. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you all. We will find a way to make Trevor Munoz's video available. I will talk with Katrina Jackson and others about how to do that. But thank you very much for your participation and questions, and we look forward to continuing the conversation. Thank you.